Hi friends. Today my guest is Robin Dreek, and he is the ex-head of the FBI's Behavioural Science Division. Now, that sounds like an incredibly secretive and exciting job to have, and it really is. Today's discussion takes us through Robin's 21-year in-field career, including when he was in Manhattan on 9/11. He was out for coffee with his friend as the first plane struck the North Tower, and then back on the 25th floor of his department when the second plane hit. Apart from that, we're also going to learn the verbal and nonverbal cues that both you can use to help encourage trust and make your communication with others more effective, and also to be able to detect deception in other people. Robin really is the real deal. It's evident that he has a very terrifying and wide-ranging skill set of personal and interpersonal communication. I'm super happy to have him on. I'm not going to pontificate anymore. Please welcome Robin Dreek. Oh yeah, P.S. We did have some connection issues during this episode. I promise that any of the cuts I made weren't due to Robin giving away national secrets. And also the irony of a podcast about communication being beset with communication problems is not lost. But there may be a couple of jumps here and there, so just bear that in mind.
All right, quick maths. The less that your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have, the more money that you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce the costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite, and you are improving efficiency by bringing all your business processes into one platform. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the maths and see how you will profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/modern right now. That's netsuite.com/modern. This episode is brought to you by Whoop. I've worn Whoop for over 4 years now, since way before they were a partner on the show, and it is the only wearable I have ever stuck with because it's the best. It is so innocuous, you do not remember that you've got it on, and yet it tracks absolutely everything 24/7 via something from your wrist. It tracks your heart rate, it tracks your sleep, your recovery, all of your workouts, your resting heart rate variability, how much you're breathing throughout the night. It puts all of this into an app and spits out very simple, easy to understand, and fantastically usable data. It's phenomenal. I am a massive, massive fan of Whoop, and that is why it's the only wearable that I've ever stuck with. You can join for free, pay nothing for the brand new Whoop 4.0 strap. Plus, you get your first month for free, and there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. So you can buy it for free, try it for free, and if you do not like it, after 29 days, they will give you your money back. Head to join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. That's join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. This episode is brought to you by AG1. AG1 is a daily foundational nutrition supplement that supports whole body health. Even with the best diet in the world, it is hard to make sure that you get everything that you need. And through a science-driven formulation of vitamins, probiotics, and whole food-sourced nutrients, AG1 delivers comprehensive support for the brain, gut, and immune system. This is why Joe Rogan and Lex Fridman and Dr. Andrew Huberman and Tim Ferriss are all massive fans. They have tried every other product out there like I have, and this is by far the best one available. Since 2010, AG1 have improved the formula 52 times in the pursuit of making the best foundational nutrition supplement possible through high quality ingredients and rigorous standards. Also, there's a 90-day money-back guarantee, so you can buy it and try it for 89 days, and if you don't like it, they'll just give you your money back. Head to drinkag1.com/modernwisdom for that 90-day money-back guarantee, a year's free supply, vitamin D, 5 free travel packs, and more. That's drinkag1.com/modernwisdom.
So So, Robin, is this the moment where the FBI burst in through the door of my bedroom and tell me that we need to stop this interview? Is that when this happens?
No, because I duck and weave really well.
Yeah. And you're on the other side of the screen, so you're going to be fine. Well, anyway, thank you very much for coming on. Welcome to Modern Wisdom. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm excited about it as well.
It's going to be a great, great conversation. So can you tell the listeners at home what your job roles were, please?
Sure. So I'll kind of give you a chronology from the beginning to the end without taking a million minutes to do this, just because it's not boring. But it's good to frame the background of where I came from to where I arrived and where I'm still going to. And that is, so my background is I graduated from the United States Naval Academy here in Annapolis, Maryland. And from there, I went on to become a Marine Corps officer. And from there, I joined the FBI. And I joined the FBI in 1997 and worked counterintelligence for my entire career. So I was assigned to the New York field office in Manhattan. From there, I went to Norfolk, Virginia. From Norfolk, Virginia, I went into management. So I went up to the J. Edgar Hoover building here in Washington, D.C. Also, throughout my entire career, I worked Russians. So that's kind of the nouveau thing these days, although for 21 years, no one is listening to me. and so when I started running the behavioral now, you know, the program at headquarters, during my time in New York, before I got there, I got on our behavioral analysis program for counterintelligence. And what the behavioral analysis program is, and a lot of people know about the profilers and the behavioral analysis units from things like Criminal Minds and movies like that. Those are the criminal guys, the guys that work on criminal cases. My team, we work nothing but counterintelligence cases. And my team's whole strategy all the time was, how are we going to create a good, healthy engagement with another human being? Whether you're trying to recruit a spy, talk to someone, interview someone, whatever it is we're always strategizing engagements. And so from FBI headquarters, I eventually escaped, thank God, because I'm not a headquarters guy, I realized. And they asked me to go down to Quantico, where I taught counterintelligence interviewing and source recruiting and things like that. And then I took over our behavioral team as the head of it back in 2010-ish. And I ran it for 3 or 4 years until sequestration, which was a big budget thing we had, eliminated my team and a bunch of things. And so I went back down to the street and I worked as an agent on the street, working counterintelligence for the last couple of years before I retired. So, yeah, my entire career has been nothing about trying to recruit spies, catching spies, talking to sources, all nothing but intel all the time.
Right. I mean, that sounds like the stuff that novels are made of, right? It's a lot of kind of the typical spy stuff. That sounds like the proper James Bond shit.
It is. You know, it's pretty funny. And I actually, you know, you being in the UK is really great. I have a saying, especially when I was in New York, I love working with the Queen, because we worked with MI5 and MI6 a lot. And I love them a lot because their funding was always better than ours. And they're great hosts. Very, very great hosts.
That's awesome. Well, I think the Brits are pretty well renowned for the fact we have good tea and, you know, the weather's not so good, but everything else.
That wasn't what we were drinking.
Yeah, I bet it wasn't. So you've mentioned there some, you know, the New York field office in Manhattan and the J. Edgar Hoover building. Those are places that I really only know as references from movies. Sure. But that sounds like a sort of place where there's an awful lot going on, a pretty big hub of activity, I'm going to guess.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, just think about this. People are generally underimpressed with their own jobs. It's, you know, because it's always the outside optic. You know, for me, it was my job. Basically, my job was to build relationships and build trust.
Yeah, I got you.
And so what was interesting was, you know, a lot of people. So, you know, I wound up writing a bunch of articles and wrote a couple books. I got another one coming out this year. And my intro to whatever I'm doing, a speech, a talk, you know, podcast, or even in my writing, it always starts out with me kind of laying out that background of mine, which says, wow, this guy is a type A hard charging guy.
Okay.
And I'll say, absolutely right. The problem is, if you want to recruit spies, you're going to fail majestically with that kind of behavior profile.
Wow. Okay. So take us through what that means and why that's the case.
Sure. Well, and this is how I really related to business with all the companies I work with, because I call my job the most challenging one in sales, because it was literally the toughest sales job I think anyone could have. And that's what I have always, when I transition and I talked to a lot of groups outside the FBI, and obviously that's all I talk to now. This is how I line it out, because when I was in New York and my job is to recruit spies, here's what that meant. First of all, you know, I'm selling a concept to someone from a foreign country, and the concept I'm selling is that helping the United States is really a good idea. And even though it might not be in your best interest for your country, it's in the best interest of my country. So first of all, I'm selling a concept, an idea that helping and cooperating with me is a great idea. So that's my product. The second most challenging thing now is it's actually illegal for me as FBI to walk up and talk to a foreign diplomat, because all the spies are foreign diplomats under diplomatic cover. And by treaty, it's actually illegal for me to approach them. So if my client that I'm trying to sell this product to, one, doesn't really care for my product, two, it's illegal for me to actually contact him about my product, that's your first challenge.
There's a couple of big barriers there.
Yeah, really are. And the other thing, so if you can't talk to them directly, you're going to maybe try to sell through third parties, you know, some of their contacts. And, you know, in law enforcement, I love to say, you know, this analogy, because most people that work in law enforcement, there's a reason why people have to talk to them. They've done something illegal. So there's a compulsion. Well, when you work in the world of counterintelligence, very rarely have people done something illegal. You know, take spies, for instance. You know, it doesn't matter what country they're in. All they're doing is collecting intelligence. And what generally is intelligence? Well, it's actually reading things in the newspaper, hearing things on the news, or looking at a blog or something like this. And so you get information. And now your next job is to source that information to people in the know. So say they read something in a newspaper, they read a blog, they see a posting. Well, now they're going to go to like the president of a clear defense contractor, another diplomat, someone from a think tank, that they can say, what do you think about this? Now they get their opinion on it. Well, now that opinion has sourcing. Now sourcing becomes intelligence. And none of that's illegal. And so there's no compulsion for them to want to talk to me because they've done nothing illegal. It's illegal for me to talk to them. They don't want to buy my product. And now I want to talk to people that are around them. And the people around them that are talking to, they're not doing anything illegal either.
Wow.
And so, yeah, so what I quickly realized, you know, when you're in your late 20s and you have this hardcore type A personality, is if you approach people with that kind of personality that don't have any reason why they should want to talk to you, you're going to get shut down really fast. And so that was my background. So luckily for me, though, I was on a squad of people that were my Jedi masters. You know, one in particular, his name's John. You know, he had this art form down. And just to give an example, you know, in my line of work or my previous line of work, getting, you know, actually recruiting a spy from another country to cooperate with us and give us all the jewels of the kingdom, it's like hitting lotto. It's that rare and it's that beneficial when it does, you know, or winning, you know, winning sweepstakes.
Yeah.
And when you do, it's extremely beneficial. So I always viewed my job every day as like buying a lotto ticket. I create operations that give me opportunity to hit lotto.
Yeah.
Or hit that sweepstakes. And, you know, unbeknownst to me, one of the guys on that I was working with that became my mentor guide and really my best friend, he had hit lotto 14 times in his career.
Oh my God. And,
yeah, no kidding. And it was really dumbfounding because I never knew that for years, just because one of his great tenets of life is he lived with great humility and humbleness. He never made it about him. His desk at work had no I love me trophies or posters on it. It was always about everyone else but himself. And that was really the key. You know, I started modeling my behavior. I tried to after him. And then when people started asking me to teach this, that was the first time I actually had to take my friend John's art form of interpersonal communication and make it a paint by number so it could be replicated.
Yeah.
And that's where all this started getting born.
That's so fascinating. I mean, it very quickly goes away from being luck and goes on to skill when you win the lottery 14 times, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
there's no luck involved with this.
Yeah, for sure. No,
and it's so funny too. Go ahead.
Did you have a background
in
psychology or in any sort of behavioral sciences before you went to the FBI?
No, actually, you know, my background was leadership from the Marine Corps, without realizing I was getting this art form better by the time I'd gotten out, came in the FBI. And actually, it was very helpful because I had all these, I probably had about 15, 17 years of field experience doing this before I actually worked on my graduate work in organizational psychology. And so I started seeing the science behind why everything I was doing in the field was working. So instead of having the education first and then trying to apply it in limited situations, I had, you know, over 21 years of experience of living this. And now I was learning the, what I call lens behind these actions behind it. So it actually was more reinforcing and made a hell of a lot more sense to me afterwards. And so it was a combining of two. Matter of fact, when I would assemble a team to do a consultation for someone in the country, typically I put at least two or three case agents that had operational experience like I did. And I put them with, you know, one of my organizational psychologists that actually could just validate the science is solid by what it is we're trying to do.
Collaboration of brains and brawn, kind of, to a degree, I suppose.
It's always, you know, and at the root of everything that we're always trying to do is, and someone once asked me too, you know, so how do you recruit a spy? I said, well, first of all, you don't. And it's like with any individual, and this is sales as well. You know, while you're trying, all human beings are trying to do is they're trying to be affiliated and validated by people. And ultimately, human beings are exceptionally predictable. And here's how they're predictable. I can always take at face value that everyone will always act in their own best interest. We're genetically coded for it. We're biologically coded for it. And now my job is to figure out what you think your best interests are. And one way we do that is, and this is where we do all the time, is I have to figure out what your priorities are. Your needs, wants, dreams, aspirations, personal, professional, long-term, short-term. And now once I figure out what your priorities are and I have resources that'll serve those priorities, we're going to align. And that's where sales comes in. That's where collaboration comes in. That's where relationships build. And so what you're doing is when, you know, whether you're talking to a new potential client or you're trying to recruit a spy, all I'm trying to figure out is what are your priorities? What are your goals and objectives? And what resources do I have to get you to that point?
So what do you want and what can I give you?
Yeah, absolutely. With full transparency, you know, the biggest thing too is, you know, I am 100% anti-manipulation or deception or pretext or any of these things, because people can pick up on manipulation or attempts of manipulation or coercion very rapidly. You know, it gives you that creepy feeling. You know, when you meet someone or, you know, bad sales guy trying to sell you something, you pick up on it immediately. And so the best thing you can do is don't have deception. I refuse to lie, cheat, or deceive or use subterfuge in any way, because it'll blow trust. And once trust is blown, just give up.
Amazing. So take us through the basics of the behavioral science as you were applying it in the field, if you would.
Sure. So my five steps that I realized that I was doing, and here's where it came from. I was asked to do an article right before I got out, and it was on, you know, what does counterintelligence do? What does your team do? And I'd never really thought about it before. Because again, when you live something, you just kind of do and act. And so I took that step back and I gave myself that optic of what am I actually doing in all these behavioral assessments? What I was actually doing in all these cases throughout my career, you know, whether it was a recruitment operation, an interview, a double agent operation, false flags, I mean, all the fun, hooky, spooky spy stuff. And what I quickly realized was all I was ever doing was strategizing trust. Because I was always trying to get and hopefully have someone move from point A to point B. Hopefully point B would be a place that we could collaborate. And the only way someone is going to move from A to B and collaborate with you is through trust. And so when I took that step back and realized, wow, in everything I'd ever done in my entire career, and then for the larger optic in my entire life, and it's what we do as human beings, we're always strategizing trust in relationships. And so I broke it down to five really simple steps. It's what I call the elusive obvious. You know, so as you said, so here's the process. It's really simple. First, what's your goal? What is it you're trying to achieve? And then the second part of that, so why should they want to? You know, why should they want to be interviewed by you? Why should they want to cooperate with you? You know, why should they want to do anything? And at first, you know, that's as surface as I got with it, thinking to myself, oh, it's a very short-term goal. But then I asked myself, well, why do I want to do that goal? Where am I trying to go with this? And ultimately, in my work, I was trying to protect national security. And ultimately, I came out with what I call the ends goals and means goals. And interviewing someone or recruiting someone or selling a product, that's really a means to the end. Mm-hmm. And at the end goal, what, you know, whether you're trying to sell a product, you're trying to honor the mission statement of the company. Me, I was trying to honor, protect the national security of my country. And what was really fascinating was so many people and things have input on those means goals. You know, there's a lot of relationships that go into, is someone willing to cooperate and trust you? So what I started focusing was on the end goals first. So I reversed it. And the end goals for me are very, very simple and easy. My number one goal in every single engagement one is a healthy professional relationship. Because without a healthy professional relationship, everything else will fall apart. I have become so adamant about focusing on relationships above all else that I preach it at every opportunity I get, because, you know, the greatest analogy I always have, whether I have a group of 1,000 people or two people, I can always say, I can guarantee you not one person is sitting in this room as successful as you are without a relationship with at least 1, 2, 10 people. Mm-hmm. Because nothing can happen from that. So I always focus on the relationships first. Second, under that, my next goal is open, honest communication and transparency, because you cannot have a healthy relationship without that open, honest communication and transparency. And my third anchor, my third end goal I always focus on is I make myself an available resource for the prosperity of others with no expectation of reciprocity. And here's how that breaks down. Available resource for others. I once offered someone help and he thought it was condescending that I was offering help. He thought I was better than he was, and so he took offense to it. So that's why I have available resources. And because human beings do not like being looked down upon, they want to be treated as equal, they want to be affiliated and valued. So I offer resources for their prosperity. Prosperity is a very open term. Prosperity according to what they think prosperity is. And the last part of this is no expectation of reciprocity. In other words, I am being willing to give my resources to you without an expectation or reciprocity. In other words, I'm not trying to do this to get something. Again, as soon as you do that, you start going into the realm of manipulation. Shields go up and trust goes out the window. Mm. So those are my three anchors, and that's step one. As long as I get set on those and I move forward, then we're great. So step two, this is easy. Discover their priorities, their needs, wants, dreams, and aspirations, short-term, long-term, personal, professional. How do they prosperity and success from their point of view? Because if you don't talk in terms of their priorities, you're wasting your voice, because everyone will listen to you if you're talking in terms of what's important to them. So step two is about them. Step three, understand their context. How do they see the world through their particular optic without judging it? In other words, what's their age, their demographic, their ethnicity, their gender, socioeconomic status, you know, all these things play into how people see world through their particular optic. And that's generally also where we find places of affiliation and that we can build upon. One of my favorite questions when dealing with lots of folks internationally is, you know, would you mind sharing a favorite family holiday you had growing up? And again, you don't have to have the same favorite family holiday, but what you have is a favorite family holiday. Yeah. Everyone has something they remember from their childhood. And when you share those kinds of things, well, look, I had a childhood just like yours. We had something we enjoyed. We had a tradition. We had a meal. We have taste. We have flavors. We have music. All these things are where we build those affiliations and we build that tribe. Because ancient tribal man, you know, a tribe of 30, 40, 50, it was the first form of survival. If you were not part of a tribe, the likelihood of you passing on your genetic coding to others was slim to none. And so we're constantly seeking to be affiliated with meaningful people in our lives and be valued by them. So this is the process by which we're doing that. So that's the third step. Fourth step, it's actually, this is where you got to make sure you're talking in terms of them. I want to suspend your ego. And that is, you know, you got to put your own thoughts and opinions aside. You got to talk in terms of them and theirs and never argue context. In other words, if they have a certain point of view that you don't agree with, what's it going to cost you to not argue it? Mm-hmm. Second, be non-judgmental, you know, because people, here's another guarantee in life. If you start judging them verbally or non-verbally, I guarantee you their shields are going up, because you're basically saying, hey, you're not part of my tribe. And so people get defensive and they'll get shields up. Honoring reason. And honoring reason is really where you want to make sure that everything you're saying and doing is congruent with what it is you're trying to achieve. Keep that thoughtful mind engaged. Don't get emotionally hijacked where you're going to let your emotions interrupt what's going on between your brain and your mouth. And so honoring reasons, I'm always asking myself, is what I'm about to do or say going to help or hinder what it is I'm trying to do? And ultimately, remember, what I'm trying to do is create a healthy relationship. Fourth is validate others. You know, validation this is just seeking to understand that a deep level is possible. It's not saying you necessarily agree with them, although agreeing with them can be validating, but just seek to understand, especially if you have a different political point of view, on religion, anything it is. You know, it's not that you're seeking, it's not that you're placating them or pacifying them. No, you're seeking to understand how it is they have that certain point of view. The key here is you have to be congruent with, you know, what's in your heart and what's coming out of your mouth. Because if your body language and your verbals are incongruent, you just look like you're, you know, you're full of it. So you have to actually be honest internally about trying to understand them. And finally, the fifth step of step four is be generous. Be generous with your time and be generous with your resources. And then finally, fifth step is craft this engagement. You know, how are you going to put all this together to have a great, meaningful, you know, genuine, sincere conversation and dialogue? And so to do that, the first thing I always do is I'm going to state a very specific validation of a strength, attribute, or action that I've witnessed. In other words, I'm going to always be seeking the greatness in others where their strengths are. So I can always start out with a conversation about, hey, when you did this last week, it had such a great result in this situation. Would you mind sharing with me how you came up with that? Would you be willing to share it with others? And from there, we just have a great dialogue and conversation. There's many other steps to that, but those are the five basic, you know, steps I used, what I call the elusive obvious. Like, how do you form a relationship of trust and health? That's it.
I get it. So it sounds like steps one through four are setting the scene and coming up with what you're going to say, and then five is delivery. Is that fair to
yes.
say?
Absolutely.
Okay. And it seems like, I think... like,
okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Based on what I thought about behavioral analysis, I thought that it would be all step five. That's probably my romanticizing a little bit of the spy industry, and then a lack of understanding of just how much stuff probably goes on behind the scenes with counterintelligence, and that the tip of the spear is exactly just that. It's the tiny little bit at the end that delivers the message or the blow or whatever it might be, as opposed to all of the work that's gone before it.
You know, you did a great job summarizing it, and you couldn't be more right. I mean, it really comes down to you have to really know people. And how do you know people? And this goes back to a lesson I learned really early on in my career in the Marine Corps. I remember I got ranked last out of all these other officers, and a very humbling moment. And I go up to the guy that's rating me, and I said, all right, what am I doing wrong? He goes, well, you just need to make it about everyone else but yourself and be a better leader. And I was like, well, I thought I was doing that. What the hell are you talking about? Make it about everyone but myself. How do you do that? What's the methodology? How do you make a conversation about everyone else but yourself? I didn't understand it. This process, this is exactly this. This is how you make it about the other person. You're finding out their priorities. You're finding out their context. And then how do you put all these things together to talk in terms of them? And, you know, you add these four things I love to throw into every statement I make is, one, I seek their thoughts and opinions. I talk in terms of their priorities. I validate them non-judgmentally, and I give them choices. When I do one of those four things and everything I say I write, that entire conversation is completely about them.
I understand. And I'm going to guess that the science will say that that plays into a sense of trust and safety and focus on them as an individual, which I'll presume will probably lower barriers and stuff like that.
Absolutely. So here's the science behind it. We know this anecdotally because when you say, hey, when someone's talking about things that are important to me, I love listening to it. And we all have experienced those moments where we've had these conversations where you said you had to go in 5 minutes, but you're there for 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes longer because you loved the conversation. Well, it's because they're validating you. So that's behind it. They did a great study at Harvard back in the spring of 2012. Where they actually wired people's brains up. And what they found was, on average, people spend about 40% of their day sharing their own thoughts, opinions, and ideas that they have. And what they're doing is they're testing the environment around them, saying, hey, here's what I think. Because we're seeking constantly to see if we can affiliate with tribes and affiliate with people. And what they found is when people were sharing their thoughts and opinions and ideas, and those thoughts and opinions and ideas are being validated by others, dopamine was being released in the brain. So the pleasure centers, you know, we're firing serotonin, oxytocin, the bloodstream. Our pleasure centers are constantly firing when we're being accepted non-judgmentally for those thoughts, opinions, and ideas that we have, because we want to be affiliated with meaningful groups and organizations for survival. So that's the science behind why when you structure a conversation, dialogue, and relationship like this, it's magic. And it's the greatest thing too, it's totally genuine. There's no, you know, I'm anti-verbal judo and how to win an argument. There's no strategy on how to do that. It's just how do you get to understand a person and make it about them?
Okay.
Piece of cake.
I get it. I get it. So the first four steps that are quite conceptual, I think must require a lot of research about the person, but to me just seem like spending time under tension. Like work out what it is that the person wants and how you can speak their language and give them choices and don't judge. But the fifth one, I imagine, requires a little bit more skillfulness.
Well, here's how I put it together. Here's how I generally structure my, and this again, I don't have my notes in front of me, going off the top of my head. What I generally do is, again, step one is I make a very specific statement of validation of a strength, attribute, or action. Now, that's if I know what one of those strengths are. If I don't, I'm going to be talking to a stranger, do a phone call. The first thing I'm going to validate is their time, because human beings do not have to give me their time. So I'm going to be extremely deferential and gracious for the time that they can give me, and also willing to walk away if they don't want to engage me. Because in order to make this conversation about them, you have to be willing to accept their denials of your time. So I start out with that. Next, I'm going to seek their thoughts and opinions about their priorities. That's step two of how I strategize. Now, if I don't know what their priorities happen to be at this point, because again, I haven't had any research, because we do this in sales all the time. We do lots of cold calls.
Yep.
But if you don't know what their priorities are, here's a general priority of every single human being on this planet: safety, security, and prosperity for them, themselves, and their families, because that's survival. And so public safety is one that I'll always go to for the things I was doing. But safety, security, and prosperity. I work with financial companies all the time that sell insurance. Well, safety, security, and prosperity for them and their families, that's a priority. So again, if I don't know what one specific of their priorities are yet, one that I can ask them about and see if and seek their thoughts and opinions on is safety, security, and prosperity for you and your family an important thing to you? And so that's step two. Now, the third way I do this next is I'm going to validate those thoughts, opinions, ideas that they just shared with me. And validation, again, if I don't understand exactly what they're saying, I'll dive a little deeper so I can get a better understanding. And now, most of the time, what we're trying to do is we're trying to inspire people to listen to our thoughts and opinions, ideas. Or in other words, what we're trying to impart on them. And I use that word inspire because that's really critical. Something I realized a number of years ago is that there's a big difference between trying to convince someone of something, want to listen, because really you really can't convince anyone of anything, because that's about you imparting what you want them to listen to. Rather, I think of how can I inspire them to want to listen to me? Because if I'm thinking of inspiring you to action, if I'm thinking of inspiring you to listen or do something, in order to inspire you to do it, it's got to be completely about you and your idea. So how do I inspire you to listen to my idea? This is easy. I'm going to ask you your thoughts and opinions and ideas about my thoughts and opinions and ideas. In other words, you know, say someone has a certain political point of view and I say, no, I don't agree with that. Here's what I think. That's me trying to convince you of my point of view and you're not going to listen. As opposed to they say the same thing. And I say, wow, I never heard it really quite put that way before. Help me understand. How did you come up with that? And they share the thoughts and opinions and ideas. And I say, wow, I appreciate that. I was curious, what do you think about this? And now I'm seeking their thoughts and opinions about my thoughts and opinions. Mm-hmm. Everyone always wants to plant seeds with people by, you know, giving them thoughts. You don't plant seeds with people by telling them what you think. You plant seeds with people by asking them what they think. And so that's where this part of the process is. I ask them their thoughts and opinions about my ideas. Ask them, hey, I understand their priorities. I've talked in terms of my priorities. Now I offer them choices of overlapping priorities. You know, I heard you say this, this, and this, and I thought this and this and this. Do you think we might be able to work on maybe X, Y, and Z? And now you're empowering them a choice. And then finally, if appropriate, I empower them a choice about remaining in contact or of assistance. That's it. That's the fifth step. That's how I line it out. And so when I'm talking to someone live, I do it that way. Or if I'm going written, I just make sure that at least every one of those things is in every single statement I make.
And now you've got yourself a spy. Now you've caught a spy and they're giving up all of the state secrets and you've got the Wi-Fi password and everything.
Only if it's in their best interest to do so.
Yeah. Fair point. So I wanted to ask about specific techniques that you guys use in the field when time is of the essence. So obviously, when we're talking about this kind of a situation, it's a, I'm going to guess there will be a word for it, like a longer game where you have time to prep, but there must be time. You know, you were in the service. I don't know what particular department you would have been in at 9/11, but you know, there's periods of time where you
I was right in New York City during it. Yeah.
Oh wow. So I mean, well, first off, can you tell us about that? What it was like in the Secret Service when that was happening?
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. Matter of fact, my next book starts out with my being right there during it. So our office in Manhattan was about 5 blocks away from the World Trade Center.
Oh my god!
And I was on the street with a friend of mine grabbing a cup of coffee, and we heard the first plane hit the North Tower. And we looked up, and it looked so small compared to the size of the building. We thought it was a small plane that hit, and immediately my mind and thoughts were going to, boy, there's no fog in the air. The guy must have had a heart attack. And I went up, my floor where I worked in the building was on the 25th floor. And so I was up in, you know, in our office looking at the North Tower, again, like 5 or 6 blocks away. The smoke kept getting larger and larger and spread out more. And finally started seeing what you thought was debris, you know, coming down from the floors in the North Tower. And it was actually people jumping because you started seeing legs and arms flailing on the way down.
Oh, wow.
And that's when the South Tower was hit by the jet coming from the south. Mm-hmm. And that fireball coming through as I was like, you're watching a movie and you're right there. So yeah, I worked counterintelligence at the time. And back then we were all in the same division with the terrorism division, and the entire office, we worked nothing but then terrorism from, you know, probably about, boy, it was from right from September straight through to December. I think it wasn't until December of 2001 when we actually had our first day off. We were on shifts of 12 hours on, 12 hours off, 7 days a week for that entire time. And it was like a war zone, you know, that kind of exhaustion.
Yeah.
Because again, that's 12 hours time, 12 off. That didn't count your commute time. and it was exhausting. But what an experience. Matter of fact, the first night, you know, on 9/11, I go down to get my car to go home, and I had an engine from the plane that hit the South Tower about 30 feet in front of me, because it had flown that far north before it hit the ground.
Shit, that is crazy. Yeah,
it was. And so our entire time then was talking to absolutely everyone. You know, there's so many leads coming in, and you just talk to everyone that might know something. I got involved in so many different interviews, so many different things during that time frame, because every day was a different day. You never knew what you're going to be doing. I was out of the Fresh Kills landfill with a rake, raking for fingers and toes and body parts to try to give back to family members one day. And another day, I'm out at John F. Kennedy Airport pulling someone off a British Airways flight that was a name hit coming in from India that they thought was a terrorist. I mean, you had no idea what you're going to do every day.
Oh, wow. That's like the Secret Service equivalent of being a dog's body, I suppose, that like not only you washing the cutlery one day, and then you delivering the drinks, and then the serving the queen, and then doing everything.
Yeah, it was a jack of all trades for a while, no doubt.
Absolutely, yeah. So with regards to needing to gain trust or be effective rapidly, yes.
So one caveat I'll put to it, anytime you put a time constraint on having to do something and you're not having full disclosure of your time constraint, you will be manipulation. And again, that's just the name of the game. You know, I think having a awareness of what you're about to do will keep things good for you, so you don't start rationalizing what the relationship is. Because if you start using manipulative tactics, you don't have a healthy relationship. You have a very short-term, you know, manipulation relationship. And mm-hmm. so it's healthy for me to do that. And I also caveat, 99.99% of my time, I never had to do that, thankfully. But when doing so, yeah, you can. They're, you know, using the same methodologies that I lined out, they're exactly the same. Human beings will do exactly the same thing. Now, when you're gaining information, there's, you know, people ask me all the time about elicitation. How do you elicit information from people? One, you can't do anything without some semblance of trust. And so you will have to develop some semblance of trust. Now, it's going to be one sided trust, because they're going to be trusting you. And even though you're actually viewing them not in the same view of, you know, not in the same relationship, but human beings have this incessant need to be correct I think one of the easiest elicitation techniques there are that people use pretty frequently is what I call an intentional misstatement. So what that is, say something that you aren't quite sure of, blurt it out loud, ask them, you know, make a statement, and they will correct you. It's a guarantee, you know, whether you're trying to gain a date of birth of someone, you know, just say, hey, I'm pretty good at this. What are you, born in June? They'll go, no, July. Go, oh, the 15th, no, the 22nd. I mean, and so right there, I got their date of birth without even asking a question. I made a statement.
Yeah, I can play that through in my mind as well. And my desire to correct you is like coming up as well.
Absolutely. So, you know, by doing that, you get a lot of people's, you know, priorities. You start understanding their intentions, you know, so whatever tidbits of intelligence you've been tasked with getting, you create a strategy about how you're going to ask, make an intentional misstatement about that specific type of intelligence. Because most of the time when you are trying to gather information, and whether you're trying to do, you know, gather corporate information, you know, for, you know, for takeovers or, you know, to outbid a client, you know, or whether you're trying to, you know, recruit information for spies, you don't want anyone else to be alerted to the things that you're looking for. Because as I said earlier, if you ask them a question, I guarantee you they're going to think about that question forever. It'll rattle around in their brain. So the trick is, don't ask questions about the things that you care most about finding out about.
Yeah, it's planting a flag in the ground to identify what your priorities are, which is not necessarily what you were after. You wanted theirs.
Right. Right. So, but I'll tell you, my earlier years, I was more into understanding and exercising that. And what I came to find out was I got better and better at getting that, the stronger the relationship and the trust was. So I go for the rapid, as fast as possible trust with full transparency, which gets that trust at that point. And then I just come right out and ask them what I want and ask and tell them why I need it. And you'd be amazed at how much easier that is.
can you give us an example?
So, I mean, just probably my last couple of years before I retired, you know, we came up, and I won't give you exact details. Mm-hmm. But we came up with a situation where we identified an emerging threat, you know, to public safety. And they said, we need to find a source in this area. And I didn't know anyone, but I went to some of my guys that, you know, are my sources of information. I said, hey, we need someone in this area. They said, I don't know, but because I have healthy relationships with them and they have healthy relationships with others, about 2 weeks later, one of my contacts brings me a potential guy, you know, doesn't introduce me, but gives me his website, gives me an email address. And I was like, this guy might be right up the, you know, right what we're looking for. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was I looked at his industry, I looked at, you know, his background, and I strategized my, and I actually sent him an email. And in the email, I validated his time. Like I said before, I sought his thoughts and opinions regarding this specific industry and the threat it might have to public safety, but at the same time wanting to protect his industry from being shut down if something from public safety went wrong. In other words, I talked in terms of his priorities. I sought those thoughts and opinions, and I said, here's why it's important to public safety, you know, because we want to prevent X, Y, and Z. And I said, would you be willing to have a conversation about this? If not, please let me know, and I'll leave you completely alone. Well, he called me with about, I think, 15 minutes. And I said, hey, Mr. So-and-so, you know, if you wouldn't mind. And he goes, oh, I'd love to help out because of what you said. It makes a lot of sense. I said, great. Would you mind if I signed you up as one of our sources and put you in the intelligence system and so that people could benefit from your thoughts and ideas and we could might protect those people? And he goes, okay. And there you go. That's as easy as it is. It wasn't using any spycraft subterfuge. It was like, hey, here's how you can be a source and here's how you can help, you know, protect people. Again, what are people's general priorities? Safety, protection of themselves, their families, and their well-being.
What I like about the approach that you're describing here is that it does come from a place of virtue. For the listeners who are regular, they'll know that we're big fans, and as far as I'm concerned, truth is a superpower. One of the main reasons that I like trying to tell the truth as much as I can, although I'm not always perfect at it, is that by telling the truth, you never have to remember what you said.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I went through undercover certification course years ago, and they said the same thing. You know, you have only so many lies you can tell, and then you got to keep the more lies you tell about who you are, the more you got to keep track of, because once they're out of the bucket, you can't bring them back again. And so I just got in the habit of not lying, and it was so much easier. I just don't lie. Now, if I can't share something with you, there's a big difference between lying and not sharing something. And if I can't share something with you that you want to know, I apologize and tell you why I can't share. Because again, I have transparency.
Yeah, there's a difference between, as Sam Harris describes it in his book, Lying, he says there's a difference between lies of omission and lies of commission. And I think that's identified quite nicely there. So we've talked about being on broadcast. What about when you're on receive? Are there some strategies that people can use to identify people that are untrustworthy or people that have an alternative agenda? And, you know, you watch these programs like Lie to Me and stuff like that, where you've got these incredibly proficient guys. For anyone who hasn't seen it, the main protagonist is able to detect a modicum of disgust at his stepmother's death, because, and that means that he did it because his eyes flicked up and to the left and all of this kind of crazy stuff. I'm going to guess that the level of fidelity is not quite that high, but that there must be some sort of guys in the service who do have some pretty crazy skills like that.
So I'm very good friends with a few of them. One of my best friends is Joe Navarro, world-renowned body language expert, and he will be the first to tell you as well. The best people in the world, including Joe, can only detect deception 50% of the time, 50% accuracy, using nonverbal detection alone, because it simply doesn't work. Because what you do is, if you're going to use nonverbals, and I do, and what you're looking for is, you're not looking for deceptive indicators. You're looking for stress indicators, because lying is stressful. But also remembering negative thoughts and events can be stressful as all. And so our nonverbals will indicate comfort from stress. And so I'm looking for, am I causing comfort? Am I causing stress? But again, that's a whole separate topic to get into. But so basically, as I heard you ask the question, I get this asked a lot too. How do I make sure I'm not being taken advantage of, or I'm not being manipulated, or attempt to be manipulated, correct?
Yes.
This one is really easy, because I get this a lot. So someone will say to me, so Robin, what do you do if someone's trying to manipulate you? And my first response when someone asked me that the first time, it kind of befuddled me, because I said to myself, wow, it's never happened. And they said, well, how does it never happen? I said, well, this is easy, because if I'm always looking for a healthy relationship, and healthy relationships are based on open, honest communication, transparency. If you are actually communicating something to me that I don't understand because there's omission or there's blank spaces, and I ask you a question for clarification, transparency, and you don't give it, I just stop engaging you, because you're obviously not looking for a healthy relationship, and it's okay with me. Again, I don't hold resentment against it. I just understand that, all right, your agenda is different than mine, and if I'm looking for transparency, you're not willing to give it, then I'm not willing to keep engaging with you. And so my only advice to people is, don't be afraid to ask clarifying questions. If you don't understand something, if people are talking fast or they're using words and terms or situations you don't quite understand, ask for clarification. Apologize, you know, self-deprecating humor, and ask for that clarification. If they can't give it to you, I become skeptical of the priorities that they have, you know, and the goals that they have. I don't think they're going to be really congruent with what came out of their mouth, especially if someone gives you that creepy car salesman, you know, feeling. It's because they're incongruent with the words that are coming out of their mouths and what they're actually feeling toward you.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of like the canary in the coal mine for all of this, right? If there's just something that you don't understand, that's a byproduct of omission on their side, or a lack of some sort of disjointedness within the conversation. And then that can be counteracted by you asking. And then if the follow-up, it's like the little hurdle that you're asking them to step over. And if they can't get over that hurdle, it's probably because they don't want to, I suppose.
Right. You stated it perfectly. Absolutely. So I just don't engage with, because again, in that situation, I take people very specific. You know, it doesn't mean I can't trust them in another situation, but in this specific situation, the things that we're talking about, no, we're not going to have a healthy engagement here. So I'll just disengage.
It sounds an awful lot like being quite frank and quite upfront, like almost not blasé, but certainly certainly very upfront and as transparent as you can be, both in terms of what you are trying to what you're trying to convey and what you do and don't understand is forming a quite a big basis here. And I suppose that the foundation for a relationship of trust is truth in two directions, right?
And openness. Yeah. You know, and because you said, you know, very frank and it can be very frank, but at the same time though, it's very extremely cordial, because it's always about them. You know, there's never me it's never me inflicting my thoughts and opinions on you about you. I don't judge you. I don't say, hey, I'm just being honest. Here's what, you're an ass. You know, that's not the thing you do. Mm-hmm. It's about being frank and open about what my intentions are and trying to understand yours. Because that's it.
Yeah, I get that. So I wanted to pick your brains as far as the classified broadcaster will allow us to just get some stories from your time while you were in the service. And the first thing that's come to mind for me is, who do you think on the planet has the best behavioral agents? Would you say that the US is really good, or do the Russians happen to be fantastic at it?
Boy, everyone's, you know, I wouldn't put it down to a service, because services and services across all countries have greatness and have inside each of those services that has the patience and the focus of trust on and put the broader need of the country ahead of their personal need for self-gratification and glory. And I've seen that in every service. I've seen some fantastic Russian officers. I've seen some horrible Russian officers. I've seen some fantastic American CIA and FBI agents and some horrible ones. And age doesn't matter. It comes down to, does this person put in the mission of the country ahead of themselves? And do they have the patience to develop healthy, trusting relationships? The people that can do that, I don't care where you're from, those are the ones that win. Because they're winning for a greater cause. That's it. I've seen it everywhere.
Yeah, I totally get that. So how about when...
Hold on. I'll give you one group that I was really, really impressed with.
Okay.
They were the United States Army Green Berets. I worked with them a couple years back. And the most different thing about them is that they were very much like my career. My career was what it was, not because of anything except just chance. It really was chance. I worked operations for 21 years. I did the same type of operations for 21 years. You're going to either get good or get out. And you know, and a lot of times in all these other organizations, you'll do it for a couple of years on a street, then you promote into management and up and up and up. And so you're no longer doing the actual craft on the ground, and you're going to lose it, because one, you never mastered it to begin with, and two, you don't do it anymore. Mm. I was very fortunate that I did it for a number of years. Then I was on the team and ran the team for a couple of years, still doing it. And then I went back and did it for 5 more years before I retired. I mean, it was nonstop, constantly strategizing, learning about what, and that's why I'm so altruistic about this, because ultimately it came down to people just want healthy relationships so they can survive. That's it. Mm-hmm. Now, how do I foster that? And so, when I mentioned the Green Berets, they spend this one particular group spent their entire career doing exactly the same thing. That's you're going to get mad skills at anything you do if you do it for that long.
Yeah.
It's just so services that allow their people to continually hone, practice, refine, and get best at their craft over years, they're going to be the best.
You end up with some real beasts at the end of that, I suppose.
Yeah, you really do. And the greatest thing is, as you call them, the real beasts, these are the ones that are actually the genuinely good people in life, because they know the cause and effect of behaviors. They know that it all comes down to relationships and trust, and there's no... These are the ones that aren't playing games with people anymore. I know people every now and then will say, hey, when we're going out to dinner, why don't you, you know, talk to that waitress to get her date of birth and her PIN number. And I'm like, it's like, dude, you understand? I don't play with people. I just refuse to play with people. I honor people too much, and I honor relationships and health and being a good human being too much to play with people.
Are there some agents that you've met who are sufficiently talented to be able to, like, if they decided to put their foot to the floor, so to speak, would be able to do some things like that and really kind of use these to get some surprising results out of people?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, I got a friend of mine, Chris Hagnaggi, social engineer, and actually I'm a board member on the Innocent Lives Foundation with him. He uses all his technical and cyber skills to protect companies, and then we took it to the next level, and we're protecting human trafficking with children around the world. And years ago, we put together a social engineering course where he certified people as social engineers. In other words, can these people go in and hack information from human beings and get the type of information that can compromise companies so that we can educate that company on protecting themselves against morons like us, you know, that are actually have nefarious things in their minds? Because, these skills used by the bad guys. That's why there are hackers. That's why there are, you know, data mines that get, you know, stolen all the time, because it comes down to human beings and these techniques. And the difference is that those people are manipulating and have an agenda, and generally agendas are on timelines. And so that's why my empowerment with choice about maintaining contact or assistance is always one of my fail safes. That make sure this isn't manipulative. Also, no expectation of reciprocity. That's my also one. But these people, the bad guys, they're doing exactly the same thing. They just have an agenda. The good thing is, though, people with agendas tend to be much more impatient than people that are actually going for healthy relationships. So impatience, you can see through impatience very rapidly.
That's so cool. I love the term social engineer as well. It really does sound like a hacker taken off the computer and into the real world.
That's what they do. I mean, these guys are phenomenal. Chris and his team, you know, are phenomenal at this, and they have competitions, you know, and when they go to Black Hat every year, and it's just pretty fascinating. When we had classes out there, and Chris about to have another class now down in Florida, you know, we send people, you know, teams out, you know, to engage people, elicit information, and practice how to do this. Again, personal identifying information or anything to be compromised or anything like that. Just how do you practice engaging with a stranger and developing rapid trust?
Yeah, I guess watching those guys at work must be pretty fascinating and terrifying in equal measure.
It becomes, you know, what's it come down to? You're watching the elusive obvious. What are they doing? They're making it all about the other person. It's really pretty simple if you know how to get out of yourself and out of your own ego.
Yeah. So one thing that keeps on coming to mind for me as well is, obviously you will have been a part of the agency through, not quite through a digital revolution, but certainly through a digital surgeons, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Did that and has that made a new body of information? Obviously, how much work is now done online and electronically versus face to face?
That was huge. You know, government organizations are generally light years behind everyone else, and ours was definitely one of them.
Well, they're big and slow. They're hard to get moving, right? Like you when you've got thousands and thousands of people that you need to drag along with you, it's going to take some time to get them up to speed.
So we went over to a paperless system 2011 to 2013-ish, maybe 2010-ish. And I thought this would never work. I mean, we were so entrenched with putting a hard piece of paper into a supervisor's inbox to wait for a signature, to get it back, to put it in a file, which was nothing but a big fat thing of paper in a wall. And I said, this is never going to work. And I'll tell you what. By the time, you know, within a couple of years, I mean, by the time I left, I'd never touched a piece of paper for years. Everything was electronic.
Man, it sounds so fucking prehistoric. Here's a thing that's going to happen, and there's a guy with a pen, and he's going to sign it. Like, you probably couldn't even find a pen now.
I always carry one. The other thing too was funny too. We moved on to, believe it or not, when I first came in, we used to sign timesheets, and we used to have different colored pencils for the different kinds of hours we worked. And so we had to have the right colored pencil when we're filling our timesheet for the day.
Oh, that's cute. That's quite cute, yeah. especially for the FBI. I wouldn't have thought that they would have had something like that.
Yeah, timesheets. Yeah, timesheets are big, and they finally got rid of that, and that went electronic too. Yeah, that was pretty funny.
That's hilarious. So. Yeah. Before we wrap up, Robin, I wondered if there were any stories that you have that come to mind that you think might interest the listeners, anything that you've been thinking about recently, or any situations with either friends or with past experiences for yourself.
Yeah, I think the world's a pretty interesting place right now. That's one thing.
Moving forward, what do you think the role of intelligence officers will be as we go forward?
It's definitely continuing. It has to be, you can only do so many things through a computer, although using the same communication strategies through computers and emails, I do it all the time, and it's very effective.
You're always going to need someone that's that tip of the spear, though, do you think? We're never going to be able to just rely on guys that are monsters behind a screen.
Think about it. You know, we have hundreds of thousands of years of evolution that say we develop trust in one way. It's not going to get wiped out, you know, in a generation that went cyber. It's genetically you can't have it happen. That's why, you know, you think about Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or any of these, you know, social media platforms, people are looking for likes. Well, why are they looking for likes? They're looking for followers because that's validation. So my anecdote is that it probably takes you about 1,000 likes equal one person saying good job in live presence. So again, these things are great. I got to tell you, they're fantastic tools and I love them to death. But still, one-on-one dialogue, communication, and trust, and having a healthy relationship that way, because you're able to look at everything that's coming at you. You're able to hear the words, the visual cues, the nonverbal cues. All these things become very congruent with, am I forming a healthy relationship? Is this genuine? And you can do an awful lot without that, but you're never going to take it over an edge with it.
That must be quite reassuring, I suppose, to a degree, that there's this kind of like an upper ceiling. And I remember listening to Sam Harris talk about the upcoming impact that virtual reality will have, and he talked about this kind of cognitive ceiling. You could argue, as you've kind of alluded to there, where there's only so far in terms of persuasion that a flat screen in your hand or in front of you on a computer will be able to take you. However, the more immersive you make that experience, the higher that ceiling is going to become raised. So with things like VR and now these new programs where they can take like 5 minutes of you or me speaking and then completely recreate whatever they want with the words and the phrases and the cadence that we've been speaking in, that's a pretty scary thought.
It is. I'm not one of these guys that says, oh, it's always better the back this way, or it was much, you know, the good old days kind of guys. I love watching the advances of things, but every time you have a new breakthrough in something, society will be confused because of our coding, our genetic and biological coding. They'll jump to it. They'll seeking immediate gratification, you know, intellectually from it in some way whatsoever. And then the brain's going to get confused for a while until they figure out how to actually make it a functional tool that actually aids life. Because it takes a while. Every time there's a new jump forward in anything, there's always a stumbling period with trying to figure out how does this actually interact with this miraculous thing between our two ears that is really the most advanced thing we'll ever see in our lifetime is this brain. It's pretty remarkable.
It's crazy, isn't it? And I guess the pace of change as well. The fact is that society is able to move so much more quickly than our brains are. And the most stupid thing is that even if our brains were able to catch up, even if you gave it like a decade to catch up, it'd still be so far behind. It would be almost pointless. Like I don't need you. Like 10 years ago, I didn't need my brain to be able to use a Filofax. I needed it to be able to use a BlackBerry. And in 10 years time, I won't need it to use Instagram. I'll need it to use whatever's coming next in a decade.
I still can't understand how I could have get anything done 20 years ago. You know, with nothing but a pad of paper and a paper calendar on my desk. I have no idea how I live without a Google Calendar or scheduling or constant communication with the world. I have no idea how I got anything done before. And then you bring it up to now. I have no idea how I get so much done now because I could not have possibly done all this kind of stuff 20 years ago. You know, what the hell did I do with all my time? it's fascinating to think about.
It must feel like, or it must have felt like, looking back on your career now, and like I say, having seen the both sides of this kind of digital surgeons to a degree, it must almost feel like two different jobs.
It's interesting. It does, and I'll give you an analogy. It's like a sense, you know, like one of our five senses. I remember I did a trip, and I won't say what country I went to, because I don't want to disparage anyone. Yep. But we did this overseas trip, and you know, we went into their command center where they have all their analysts sitting inside this command center, and they had so much technological capabilities with following people in their own country, like the spies in their own country, that I remember one of them said that, yeah, it was a bad day if we only have 95% of this person's day covered, or we knew what they were doing. They knew what this guy was doing 95% of the time because of their technological coverage. Wow. And they asked us, and I was like, maybe 10% of the day we know what they're doing. But you know what their challenge was? They couldn't recruit sources. They had a very, very hard time using interpersonal skills to actually get human bodies recruited. And so they were massively behind in a lot of areas because one of their senses was enhanced, the technological sense, but their other sense of interpersonal skills was completely thrown out because they relied too heavily on the other.
There was a compensatory mechanism.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And us, our interpersonal skills tend to be higher because our constitution keeps us from doing anything like that.
Well, when you're skinned, you need to rely on your skills, don't you? You can't be spending loads of money on things. Interesting statistic. I was watching a Amazon documentary recently, and they said that if you took the data that was collected on everybody on the earth and you printed it on an A4 piece of paper, double-sided A4 piece of paper, every day's worth of data that gets collected would go from here to the sun and back four times. So the stack of paper of data that is collected on a daily basis, and most of it's just garbage, gobbledygook to do with like location data and how many bytes of this and what address was it sent to, so on and so forth. But that's the volume of data that's to the sun and back four times. I just thought crazy, I thought that was unbelievable. Yeah. And the another statistic that they dropped was that the maddest thing to do with how efficient it is, and you were talking earlier on about having the paper going in and out and all this sort of stuff. If you were to remove all of the hardware and just have the electrons, so the actual atoms that are containing the information that the internet and all of the collective human knowledge electronically is held on, it would be about the size and the weight of an orange. So you think you've got everything and all of the banks and banks of computers and the servers at Google and all of this, sort of, even the hard drive in your house, and it's like just an orange. That's all you've got.
Yep. And humbling, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And then you compare that with to the sun and back four times a day. And I think it's probably a pretty big credit to yourself and also the guys that you worked with that you were able to survive and adapt through that particular period, because it must have been super turbulent.
It's like anything, you either get on board or you get out. And it really, I really try to keep things as basic as possible. And they did, man, I'm so sick of systems getting updated. And it usually, I've got a credo in life. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, nothing was broken. They fixed it every day anyway. It drove me up a wall.
Yeah. Yeah. I bet it was. So Robin, can you tell the listeners about your books, please, and where they can find you online?
Yeah, sure. So first, let's do find me online. That's easy. My website is www.peopleformula.com, all one word, People Formula. I'm on LinkedIn, obviously. Twitter is @rdreke, R-D-R-E-E-K-E. Follow me there. I don't post a whole lot, and I don't take – here's the other thing, too. I never take sides. I just take science and human interactions, because here's another guarantee in life. Take a side. Half the world will line up against you. I don't like that. And then, so my books, I have one, my first book came out years ago called It's Not All About Me, The Top 10 Techniques for Quick Rapport, and get on Amazon in any country. That's a short read, about 20,000 words. My last book that came out is called Code of Trust, an American Counterintelligence Expert's 5 Steps to Lead and Succeed. That's also all over the place. That was with St. Martin's Press, great publisher I worked with there. And then my next book coming out, actually, it's on behavioral analysis. And it's the 6 signs that you can actually judge whether you can trust someone or not. Actually, and more likely, it's predict their behavior. And we're still working on the title right now. What's our current working title? Just slipped my mind. We've had about 3 or 4.
Working titles. I love the journey that things go through. Like when we were coming up with the title for this podcast, and I went through like this 6-month period while I was like pre-recording shows and doing things. When I look back, I went back through my notes not so long ago, and I'm going through and I was thinking, what the fuck were you thinking? Like just looking at all of these crazy names, and it's because after a while, it's kind of like the name of a pet, right? Like the book,
right.
your book names will roll off your tongue as if it was a child's name. But during the process, you look at the words with such like high fidelity. You're like, is that even a word anymore? It doesn't sound like a word. It doesn't look like a word.
Actually, I just remembered it. It's called Sizing People Up. is what it's called right now. It probably will be too. It's probably what's going to wind up being, sizing people up.
Nice. Well, if it changes, we'll know that you've had a you've had a creative wobble.
Another creative wobble. That's a good description of it too. I have creative wobbles every day.
Yeah, back and forth. Well, Robin, man, it's been absolutely fascinating. I'd love to get you back on again soon, as I'm sure that the listeners will be very interested to see what comes out with the next book. And good luck finishing it off.
Hey, thanks. Appreciate it, Chris. And thanks for all your time.
Awesome. Thanks, man.